Ladies and gentlemen, it is time to start our before last lecture, which will be on the foundations of welfare economics. The subject of welfare economics is, the main problem is to give a scientific foundation for public policy. To make a long story again short, is the main problem that we encounter here, it's a very fundamental problem, is to define a criterion that would permit us to distinguish between better and worse policies. Is there such a thing that a criterion that would allow us to make such a distinction, or is such a distinction invariably bound up with value judgments? Economic science is a value-free science. That is, the truth and falsity of economic propositions can be evaluated according to the truth criterion alone. They do not make any statements about which policy should be pursued. So we have here the concept of value of freedom, which was stressed in particular by a German sociologist of the name of Max Weber. He was not the first one to make this observation, but there was a big debate in the German Economist Association in the early 20th century. Most economists of the time belonging to the so-called historical school of economics held that economics was invariably bound up with value judgments. So you could not, there was no such science that was not somehow premised on value judgments, what the scientists believed to be good or bad. And Weber held that that was then not a science at all. So it might very well be that economics was premised on value judgments, but then economics wasn't a science at all. Rather, science, in a strict sense, is about is propositions rather than are propositions. So we have here another name, namely David Hume, British philosopher of the 18th century, who stressed the distinction between is and ought, is and ought propositions. So Hume said in particular that there's no way that we can arrive at an ought proposition by starting from premises that are is propositions. Right? So for example, you can say, well, this room has a surface of 150 square meters, and there are 130 lamps. Therefore, the government should regulate the number of attendees to this conference. Okay, so that sounds ridiculous at first glance. And what Hume said, well, whenever you have such a thing, it is always the case that the ought statement cannot be logically derived from the is statement. It's a different, distinct logical character. So the question then is, how is it in economic science? To give you just one example, how economic propositions that show that economic propositions are is propositions that can be used in various ways according to different value judgments. Let's consider the labor market. So we have here supply of labor, and we have a demand of labor. And we know that, so you have quantity, labor hours, and we have here the wage rate, nominal wage rate, a big W. And in equilibrium, we have an equilibrium wage rate and an equilibrium quantity. And so now we can do various things. And in particular, we can imagine or analyze the impact of a minimum wage law. So let's say the minimum wage law fixes the minimum wage rate at this level here. What will be the impact on the labor market? Well, there will be none. Okay. Because the market wage rate, the wage rate that comes to be established spontaneously on the market is, if we fix the minimum wage rate here, so it will be none, right? The market wage rate is higher than the minimum wage rate, so there's no problem at all. A problem arises if we set the minimum wage rate here, because at this rate, we have this demand for labor, but this supply, okay? So we have a difference between demand and supply, and this difference is called unemployment. That's right. Okay, so we have a higher supply of labor than demand for labor. And this is exactly what unemployment is all about. Now, this is a purely fact-based analysis. There's no value judgment here, whatever. We don't say unemployment is good or bad, or it is good or bad that there is such a thing as a demand for labor, is it good or bad that there's a supply of labor. Well, as we know that some socialists, and I mentioned this yesterday, right, they think that it's bad that there should be a market for labor, right, because it's denigrating and demeaning for human beings to sell labor hours and so on. But we're not concerned about this. It's a fact that there is such a thing as an exchange taking place. So we're not concerned about the moral evaluation of this. We're just saying it's a fact that these exchanges do take place, and if the conditions are such that the minimum wage rate is set above the market rate, then we do have unemployment. Okay. Now, in fact, this purely factual information can be used according to different value judgments. For example, the natural reaction, I think that's the according to my value judgment, that's the normal, the non-pathological reaction faced to this information is to say, well, minimum wage laws are bad, right? Because either they don't have any impact at all, if they are lower than the market wage rate, or if they are higher than the market wage rate, well, they bring about unemployment, so they bring about misery for some people, right? And so my value judgment would be, well, therefore then we should not have minimum wage laws. Okay. Now, but that does not follow at all. So my ought here does not follow at all from the is analysis. You can very well arrive at a very different conclusion. For example, you might say, well, I want to have minimum wage laws precisely because it brings about unemployment. And that seems to be absurd, but in fact it is not that absurd, because there are historical cases where we can identify political proposals that boil down exactly to such a position. The matter becomes clearer if we think about, well, who will be actually fired, who will become unemployed if we have minimum wage laws? Well, it will be those people whose the marginal productivity of whose labor is inferior to the minimum wage laws, right? So if we have, let's see, the minimum wage, or the market wage rate would be something like whatever, €8 or €7, and then market would be 10 or 11. And then we set the minimum wage law slightly higher, let's say 12 or so, or 13. Well, it's clear that it wouldn't be Bill Gates who will become unemployed, okay? Will not be most professors and so on. But it will be people whose value productivity of whose labor is low. So who is this typically? Well, inexperienced people such as children, handicapped people, immigrants, right, whose access to the labor market is reduced by the fact that they don't master the language, and similar things, females looking for part-time jobs, and so on. Now, based on this information that it will be some rather minorities or low-performance groups that will be affected most, it might be that you have politicians who seek precisely this outcome. For example, in the early 20th century, the California labor unions have pressed for minimum wage laws, mm-hmm. precisely because they knew that the Chinese immigrants, so their main competitors on the market, would be affected most. During the 19th century, most labor unions in Europe have pressed for minimum wage laws because they knew that these laws would affect child labor most, okay, and female labor. Today, we might say in the US, there are some bad mouths who say, well, the certain Democratic politicians advocate minimum wage laws because they know precisely that these laws will create misery among their main constituency. So they want to create miscontents and unhappy people, because only then they create conditions of social unrest that would create greater left-wing radicalization among their constituency. So this, of course, all this seems to be rather perverse, and I think it is perverse, according to my value judgments. But what we see here, and that is my point, is that you can arrive at very different odd statements based on the very same information is information that economic science provides you with. Okay, so economics is value-free, it's purely fact-based information, and then you can make very different uses with it. Now the question is, and that's again, as I've said, the question of welfare economics is, can we go beyond this? Is it really, are we limited in our statements to these fact-based is statements, or is there something that we can say beyond this? And here I will discuss today four approaches. The first one is one of the classical economists. Then I'll talk about the modern economics in general, then in particular about the Pareto criterion. And then finally, I'll discuss Professor Hoppe's approach. Okay, so the classical economists, so how did they address this question? One particularity about the classical economists, in particular Adam Smith's theory, has been further developed by Say and Ricardo, that despite all criticisms that might be addressed against the British classical school, still is important. Namely, Adam Smith has so far developed the only tenable growth theory. Okay. When the marginalist revolution arrived, about which we have talked much yesterday, there was a shift in emphasis in what the problems that economists were dealing with from the classical economists, who mainly dealt with questions of growth, okay, to the new problems that had to do with price theory and equilibrium and so on. Okay. So, and as a consequence, we have new neoclassical growth theories that are not growth theories at all. So if you read articles, or there's a whole branch of economics that is growth theory today. Growth theory today has nothing to do with what economists were doing in the 19th century. Okay, modern growth theory, the main problem of modern growth theory is to specify the conditions under which you can have equilibrium, or general equilibrium, in a growing economy. It does not specify the conditions under which you do have growth. And that was the great subject of the classical economists. What the classical economists explained was that there were only two ways of increasing growth. One was the division of labor, and the other one was capital accumulation. Okay, because only by capital accumulation can you increase the quantity of capital goods, that is ultimately tools that make human labor more physically productive. Okay, I won't go into detail, but it has to do with what economists call the laws of return. We have here the quantity of a factor of production, and here we have the physical return, the product, physically defined. We always have something like this, a curve like this, right? And the only way to change this limitation that we see here, this maximum, is to add tools. If we add a tool, we get something like this, right? That's the curve, that's the physical product of a fisherman fishing with his bare hand, okay? This is the curve of a fisherman fishing with a net or with an angle, okay? So it's only by adding up tools that we make our labor more physically productive, but we, in order to have tools, in order to produce tools, we need to have capital, we need to save. Okay, so that's the story. Now, the classical economists from this observation jumped somewhat naively to the conclusion that capital accumulation is always good. The more capital, the better. Okay, that's a conviction that you find pervasively in all the writings of the classical economists. And it has led to certain excesses at the end of the 19th century and in the early 20th century, when people of the sort of John Maynard Keynes, but also others, started thinking about ways of how you could, through political intervention, artificially increase capital accumulation, right? And in particular, through manipulating the money supply. But even if we abstract from these excesses, there is the fact that we cannot say from the if statement that the only way to make human labor more physical productive is to increase the capital supply, that we ought to increase the capital supply, right? That we ought to save more and so on. That by no no means follows. Right? At all points of time, we have to choose between greater physical productivity of our labor in the future, that is greater availability, greater wealth in the future, and greater wealth now. Right? In order to have greater wealth in the future, we need to save now, that is, we need to cut down on our present-day consumption. Okay, there's no other way, so there's a trade-off. But there's nothing in economic science tells you that you've got to save more. Right? You can as well decide, well, I mean, I'll continue my hand-in-mouth existence, I just consume everything that I produce, and so I'll stay on a fairly low level of economic development. Yes, why not? And in a market economy, in a free society, this problem is solved, or this question is answered through the interaction of many, many individuals. Right? The overall result is then the combined outcome of each individual's decision. So everybody has some impact on the overall outcome. And that's how all this question is answered. But economic science cannot give an answer what the optimal growth rate would be, so what the optimal savings rate would be, and so on. So we have here a limitation. The second approach is the approach of the modern economics. Now, as I've said, in modern economics, there was, with the marginalist revolution, a shift in emphasis from problems of growth and capital to problems of the analysis of market pricing, right? Value theory, price theory, the theory of general equilibrium. Unfortunately, we have to drop our general equilibrium lecture today, so I'll just elegantly step beyond this. Right? And as I've explained to you yesterday, with the modern marginalist revolution, the explanation of market prices was shifted from cost of production to utility or value. And before, so to say, the prices were explained from the side of the factors of production, now all prices were explained from the side of consumer utility and so on. So it was only natural to try to explain or try to justify public policy in terms of utility. And the problem here, the main problem that we confront here is already, as I said yesterday, that utility and the famous util are abstractions. Right? Even for one individual, we cannot define such a unit. Okay, that would somehow sum up in a realistic manner all the different enjoyments that he derives from various consumer goods. But it's even more difficult if we make such a statement for society as a whole. Right? Some economists, of course, heroic as they are, have posited the existence of such a thing as a social utility function. Right. And so we have here aggregate products, so this is GDP, and here we have the big social U, right, and then decreasing marginal utility, right, for society as a whole. Now, as I said, that is heroic, right, because you make such an assertion in utter disregard for reality. There's no such thing. Already this here is an abstraction, right? It's a fiction. It presupposes that we have some common denominator for physically very heterogeneous goods. And then you posit the existence of a social utility, even though we cannot even define what utility is for one individual. Now, even before the social utility function theory has been developed by the mid of the 20th century, several economists have become aware of the essential problem of any such approach that tries to solve or solve the question of political decision making from an aggregate point of view. And this is the problem of interpersonal comparisons of utility. And the man who has pioneered the analysis of this problem was a Czech Austrian economist by the name of Franz Chuel. In a book that he published in 1907 with the title Zur Lehre von den Bedürfnissen, on the theory of needs. Okay? And here Chuel pointed out that we can talk meaningfully of utility only in the context of choice. Right? So as a predecessor of Mises, Mises was strongly influenced by him. And he also pointed out that we cannot therefore compare, it's even impossible to compare the decisions and therefore the utilities that for one individual at different points of time, because there are different choices involved, and it is all the more impossible to compare the utilities for different individuals because there are also different choices involved. Right, so we cannot do this. Now that is significant because this book was known to all the young Austrian economists that were members of Böhm Bawerk's seminar, and therefore it was also known to Ludwig von Mises. And not surprisingly, therefore, it was not Mises who was part of those who developed the social utility function theory. Right? So he always refused this. Many years before, the critique of interpersonal comparisons of utility came to the consciousness of Anglo-Saxon economists, and it came to the consciousness of Anglo-Saxon economists through Lionel Robbins. In a book that Professor Hoppe already mentioned, right, the 1932 book, The Nature and Significance of Economic Science, and there Robbins discussed this problem, said it's a big problem for aggregate social analysis. Now, Mises then is known as a famous theoretician of the market economy, as a great opponent of government interventionism. How can he oppose government interventionism if he sticks to economic science? That is, if he sticks to the is, how can he arrive at the ought statement? Well, that this policy is wrong from a scientific point of view, that it's unjustifiable from a scientific point of view. And it is significant that Mises, in full consciousness of Chuel's work, worked around this problem and found a way of discussing public policy in purely in is terms, that purely as a factual problem. And what Mises pointed out is the following. Mises said that economists cannot tell us what we ought to do, but since economics is about the analysis of causal relations, and it's also between cause and effect, so also the causal relations between means and ends, we are in a position as economists to analyze whether a given means is fit to attain a given end, that is a predefined end. And this allows us as economists to make factual statements within a given context of a public policy debate if we take the point of view of those who advocate a given policy. For example, come back on this minimum wage law business, right, with the labor market and then the minimum wage law. What Mises says is, if somebody advocates minimum wage laws is saying, well, they will have no impact on employment, we can say, well, that is factually wrong. Right? So it's a wrong policy. The policy, to the extent that the policy is designed to increase employment, it's a wrong policy. We, as economists, we can say it just doesn't work. Right? So we can reject this policy, but we don't do it in the light of our own value judgments. Rather, we take the standpoint of the person who advocates the policy. Okay. And since we are only dealing with means and ends, so only with the relations between facts, and we take the point of view of those who say that there is a certain relation here, and we show that it's wrong. And Mises took various other, analyzed various other examples. And his most famous example was the milk market, right? A big problem after World War I in Austria when there was misery, especially poor families and so hardly could feed their children. And then there were public measures designed, for example, price control on milk, the official justification for which was, well, we need to make milk more available for poor families. Now, a price control on milk has very much the same effect here, the price control here. So we set the price below the equilibrium price, so this would be the milk market, right? And the market price would be here, and so there are people who are complaining that all the poor families and mothers cannot feed their children, right? Milk is too expensive. And now Mises says, look, I mean, if we set the milk price here officially, what we get is this: the supply will lag behind the demand. Why is this? Because at the lower price, milk production, there will be marginal milk producers, those who could produce milk profitably only at the slightly higher price. And if we decrease the price, these people will go out of business, will not produce anymore. As a consequence, the milk supply will actually be reduced. Right? It would no longer be this quantity that otherwise would have been on the market. It would now be this quantity. And at which price will this new quantity be sold on the market? Well, it would be sold at this price here. That would be the black market price for milk. Okay, so we increase the problems rather than diminish them through this proposed policy. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is the only approach. The importance of Mises' approach is that it is the only approach that we have at our disposition in economics, as far as economics is concerned, to discuss public policy and to say, well, this is a good or a bad policy. That's the only way, that's as far as we can go. Okay. There's another approach to which we come now that is much more famous than Mises' approach and is known under the name of Pareto criterion approach. So Wilfredo Pareto, famous Italian mathematical economist, who argued as his master in thought, Leon Varras, that in general equilibrium, the social aggregates of society reaches an optimum. Okay, so if you reach general equilibrium, this is the optimum point for society. Why is this so? Because in general equilibrium, no more arbitrage processes are possible. Right? What is arbitrage? Arbitrage is, take an easy example, if I buy at in a part of the market where the price is low and sell in a part of the market where the price is still high, I reap a profit and nobody else is worse off. Right? The guy from whom I buy at the lower price, he's better off than the guy to whom I sell at the higher price, you know, decreasing the price slightly, he's better off as well. So it's a Pareto superior move, that's how it is called, right? Until finally we reach general equilibrium in which it is impossible for any market participant to increase his position, to improve his position, right, without at the same time deteriorating the position of somebody else. Okay, so that was Pareto's argument. And as it is ever the case in the works of the mathematical economists, as soon as they set out to derive odd propositions or make statements about optima and so on, they fall prey to the problem of interpersonal comparisons of utility, because we have exactly this problem here. It is not the case, as Pareto held, that we could somehow avoid this problem by stressing general equilibrium. For what is taking place here? Is it really the case that nobody is worse off? Let's again consider the case of the trader who buys in a market where the price is low and sells in a market where the price is high. What is he doing? Well, he's taking business away from some people who would have bought at a lower price in the market where the price was low. right? And now he's selling in the other market where the price is high at a slightly lower price. So again, he's taking business away from other people who would otherwise have sold there. Okay. Now, that's one problem. The other problem is the so-called problem of the envy person, of the envious person. I, for example, might be an outsider, an outstander. I don't have anything to do with this market at all, but I have some aesthetic prejudice. Okay, I feel well if there are some prices that are low and other prices that are high. And I just don't like it if there's general equilibrium. Right? I just hate this. And my utility dramatically decreases if general equilibrium comes about. So what do we do with this person from a general equilibrium standpoint? His utility decreases as we move closer to general equilibrium. Right? Again, that's a problem. How do we bring him into the picture without engaging in interpersonal comparisons of utility, without adding up and subtracting from one another the utilities of different persons? Impossible. Okay, so here we have the fundamental problem of the Pareto approach. And the reason why this cannot be considered of this theorem that the market in general equilibrium is welfare maximizing cannot be considered a scientific statement. Now, Pareto himself, in the mathematical appendix to his textbook, Manual of Political Economy, pointed out that his theorem holds under a given definition of appropriation rights. Okay, so he doesn't put this in the main text. He says it. He points this out in the mathematical appendix. Okay, where you wouldn't expect it at all. Right? So he said, well, by the way, so my theorem holds under, if we assume, given system of appropriation. Okay. Now, here, then, we get already we are halfway already at the solution that Murray Rothbard has developed in 1956 in an article with the title, Toward a Reconstruction of Welfare and Utility Economics. It's a piece that is widely quoted in the Austrian literature today, even as it pertains to welfare economics. And here, Rothbard argued that the free market is inherently welfare maximizing. Okay, by the very fact that in the free market we have social interaction premised on the respect of property rights, every interaction, whether it's a gift or an exchange, automatically improves the position of both people interacting with one another. Okay. So Rothbard then more consciously than Pareto acknowledged also the importance of appropriation, the appropriation mechanism here. And he said, well, as soon as we have violations of property right, we can make no longer this assertion that both parties are better off. So therefore, ipso facto, all other systems apart from the free market, interventionism, socialism, and so on, must be less welfare maximizing, right? Okay, so what is the problem with this argument? The problem with this argument is it's fine as far as it goes, right? But it is premised on the notion that we count in our analysis only those value judgments or only those utilities that are expressed through the use of property rights and through the respect of property rights. Right? That is, if somebody, only what you do with your own property, that you, what you demonstrate, the preferences that you demonstrate through the use of your own property, only those preferences count. Okay? So the position of the envious bystander is excluded by definition. We say that doesn't count, we keep this crazy guy aside, only what you do with your property, only this counts as demonstrating utility. Now, that's fine as a definitional approach, but of course you need to justify this. Right? I mean, that seems to be rather arbitrary, as long as you give no scientific reason why you should only consider those actions and not also the feelings of envious persons and so on. And here then, we come to Professor Hoppe's work, which is, in my opinion, the only approach so far in which we have the successful attempt to work around precisely this problem. For what Hoppe does is to try to justify private property rights based on a purely factual analysis. So Hoppe's approach has been called argumentation ethics. My opinion, that's not a very appropriate name, but I will just describe what it is all about, what the argument is all about, and then you can judge for yourself how we should best describe this. So what Hoppe says is property rights or political discussions, political justification of political measures invariably take place in the context of a debate, so in the exchange of an argument. Okay. Now, an argument itself is premised on the, so we need to analyze more carefully what an argument is all about. What we do in an argument is to make an appeal to our discussion partner to behave differently, or to think differently at least, than he would have behaved or thought without our argument. But in so doing, we acknowledge implicitly from the very outset that he has legitimate control over, well, at least his body, his brain, and so on. Otherwise, the argument wouldn't make sense at all. Right? And of course, we also claim, we assume implicitly as well, that we are the legitimate owners, exclusive legitimate owners, of our vocal cords and of our body, of all elements that we use to make this argument. And if we needed the permission of some other person in order to use our own voice and so on, well, we couldn't make an argument. So invariably, what we presuppose in as far as a political discussion takes place at all, and that is something that is assumed by all sides taking part in a political argument, is that there are absolute property rights pertaining at least to one's body, valid at least for the discussion. Now, this is the starting point then from then. If we grant then that we have to assume property rights in order for a discussion to be possible at all, it also follows that any justification of violations of the property that one has one itself is inherently contradictory. You cannot argue this through. If I say, well, you are not the owner of your body because so-and-so, in making this argument, I contradict myself because I implicitly assume that you are in factual control of your body and should exercise this control of your body. So I contradict myself. Right? Since only then the justification of absolute property rights in one's own body can be justified, and violations of this this property right cannot be justified, we have a starting point from which on we can explain the justify and the appropriation of other objects than one's body through one's labor. So it's the usual John Locke's homesteading argument. And we can also explain why all justifications of infringements of property rights in material objects are contradictory in turn. Okay. So then what we have here in Hoppe's theory, in my opinion, is a praxeology of justification processes. It's a purely fact-based analysis of what the processes are that are taking place in public policy debates. Right? And the conclusion is that only justifications of private that assume the validity of private property can be valid, whereas all justifications of violations of private property right run into a priori contradictions. Right? Right? Any argument that contests the validity of private property rights per se, so not a particular right, right? You can contest the property right that a robber has in something that he's stolen, okay, but we cannot contest the validity of private property per se without running into a contradiction. Right? So again, we don't have here an odd proposition, right? Therefore argumentation ethics is not quite correct. Right? Hoppe doesn't say, well, we ought to respect private property rights, but he tells us we cannot justify violations of private property rights without self-contradiction. And on the other hand, we can only justify private property rights without contradiction. So in conclusion then, and to wrap this up and get back in time, and we have science that is value-free, and scientific analysis can help us in two ways to settle public policy debates, to settle the question what is better and what is worse. One is Mises' approach, in which we take the point of view of our discussion partner and examine whether the means that he proposes to for the attainment of a certain end is in fact a suitable means, is objectively suited to attain this end. That's one approach. And the other one is that we take the point of view of the praxeology of justification processes and examine whether a proposed policy can be argued through without self-contradiction or not. That is as far as we can go, as far as I can see. And I'll give you 2 minutes to raise any questions about this. Yeah.
At least under the same headline as your lecture, it's a work of James Buchanan. Mm-hmm. Just briefly, if you could give an assessment or judgment of his work.
Yeah. So James Buchanan, alone among neoclassical economists, has realized that we cannot decide policy questions in terms of utility, so we cannot do this based on this, and we cannot decide the performance of an economic system without the rules, without judging implicitly the rules of transformation of an economic system. So that's the message that he has stressed in great detail. But of course, he has not gone all the way, because it would have led him to conclusions very different from his own. Right? One of the great projects of James Buchanan was to justify the minimal state. Right? There's this book, The Limits of Anarchy, 1975, in which he has tried to give a justification of the minimal state, which brings him, now irrespective of the merits of his justification, it brings him in the position that he has to accept the legitimacy of at least two completely contradictory methods of appropriation, right? On the one hand, appropriation through consent, mutual consent, and on the other hand, appropriation, at least in some cases, when the government is involved, namely, without consent of the previous owner. So there's a contradiction here. Right, so. Yeah, Buchanan is much more sensitive to this issue than any other mainstream economist. Yeah. Another question? Okay, thank you.